From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Today we devote the whole program to issues surrounding children's health. Later we'll hear about doctors trying to address cerebral palsy. But first, seasonal affective disorder is a temporary depression that often shows up in the winter months. The American Academy of Pediatrics estimates 3% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 suffer from it. But child and adolescent psychiatrist John Kuffner of Peninsula Lighthouse in East Tennessee says it's hard to calculate the real number of children with SAD. As a result, he tells Matt Schaefer Powell, he believes the condition is underdiagnosed.
What is seasonal affective disorder?
I describe seasonal affective disorder as the human version of hibernation. That is when it gets darker out, you have less sun exposure, and your body starts to develop some sorts of reactions to that. So bears go to sleep during the winter. They're turned on by atmospheric pressure or length of the day. Same thing can happen to people. So when the light drops down and you're not getting enough exposure, something is triggered that can put you into a depressive episode during the winter or darker months. I mean, because the other symptoms of it are going to be like there's a lot of increased carbohydrate craving. So you basically gain a lot of weight, have no energy, feel depressed. You're not motivated. You can be more irritable. It can bother your ability to, with your family relationships or work relationships. So it can be dramatic or it can be mild.
How prevalent is it with children? I mean, are there children who are also suffering from seasonal affective disorder?
It is rarely diagnosed in kids. It is a phenomenon in children. So the first thing, this is usually diagnosed later in your 20s because you have to have history. So children are growing and developing history. It's hard to come up with a start and stop point. This is not a depressive disorder that lasts all year. This comes on in the winter months and goes away in the spring if you have seasonal affective disorder. Kids just don't have a long enough history for us to be able to clearly document that. They also have some confounding variables that make it difficult to even take that good history because they have breaks in their schedule, changes in schedule. So they have Christmas break, winter break. Parents are also spending more time at home with their kids during that time. There's more chance for negative interaction. So it's really difficult.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you what, for instance, a teacher should look for. But what you're saying here is the teacher can look for certain symptoms and patterns with a child, but the teacher doesn't have the luxury of being with that student throughout that entire winter period. There's a big chunk of that time where the teacher is not in any sort of communication with the child.
Teachers probably aren't going to be the ones that pick up on this because when they're with kids, they're in pretty structured environments and you'd have to watch declining grades and then rising grades. So you'd have to do well at the beginning of the fall semester, but poorly in the winter and then do poorly again and then well in the springtime. So that's a pretty hard history to unravel.
So who should be watching then? Is it the parents probably?
The parents, absolutely. I mean, they're the ones that spend the most time with their children. They're the ones that have known their children over many years. So a teacher will know a kid for one season or one year. You need to notice if your child just isn't doing as well in the winter, like doesn't have as much energy, just isn't as willing to go out and do things, doesn't want to go outside, doesn't want to play with their friends as much as they used to. And the appetite, eating more, craving more junk food. And then suddenly, when the springtime comes, like they go back to sort of a normal diet and activity level.
John Kuffner is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Peninsula Lighthouse in East Tennessee. John, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Dr. Kuffner tells us the most effective treatment for children with SAD involves daily exercise and exposure to bright light through an electronic device called a light box. Many adults use that same technique. And now WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper speaks with two University of Tennessee researchers who are studying the effects of a certain kind of surgery on children who have cerebral palsy.
The surgery in question is called rectus femoris transfer surgery, which disconnects the rectus femoris muscle from the front of the knee and reattaches the muscle to the back of the leg. A software framework that will eventually allow researchers to predict the effects of this surgery on individual patients before the surgery is in development by doctoral student Misag Mansouri and his advisor, Jeff Reinbolt.
There's over 500,000 people that are affected by this movement disorder. And so what we see is they either have a stiff knee gait where their knee does not move very much at all. And then the other movement disorder we see is crouch gait where their knee is bent a lot and it kind of stays bent as they move around. And so there are some surgeries and some treatments that they can have that will help them move better. A lot of times they'll do a surgery and it will work really well and the patient gets better. Other times you'll see that they do the same surgery, but because it's a different patient, the surgery may not correct it as well as they would expect. And so that's kind of what led us down this road is, can we use engineering and mechanics and our optimization background, and can we be able to predict the outcome of a surgery before the person has the surgery? But what we're trying to do is be able to model a specific patient. In this case, it would be the children. And then can we perform the surgery on the model? So again, in the computer, the virtual world, and then predict how will they move afterwards.
So how many patients have been put into the database?
So, the database is of the clinical, like the actual patients, is in the thousands. For us, it takes a long time just to make one. And so for what MISOG has been doing is working on more of the framework and being able to bring that information in and really bridge gaps between the experimental database and what we would do in the computer or the virtual world, and how can we make that workflow faster. And so that's really where MISOG's dissertation is being able to bridge that gap and bring that information in, create a simulation quickly, and then try to make a prediction with it.
The reason we're doing mostly simulation studies because it's really hard to find like experimental data of our children. We mostly like using like the anthropometric data of all these children, and then we scale our model to specific subject size. We mostly trying to develop like a different type of controller. We call it like low level and high level controller, which is we define it as like a spinal level controller and like a brain level controller. There are a lot of simulation studies going on, but they're mostly tracking actually the experiments. They're only limited to track specific movement, and there's no really a brain for these models. So what me and Jeff are mostly interested in our research is, we know that we cannot really create like a controller as complex as brain, but that's like a direction we're going. First of all, we're trying to make our model stand up, and then we're trying to reject disturbances and balance. And I know Jeff's research is going to go mostly towards walking and gait in the next few years.
You can hear a longer version of Chrissy's conversation when you check out The Method online at WUOT.org. That's it for this edition of the program. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.